Thanks, Eduardo. Paul Canfield told me at the coffee break that the first talk was profound, the second was banal, the third would be profoundly banal. So I have that's a grand, well, for me, probably not. Anyway, what I'd like to do is say a little bit about whether high-TC superconductors would be useful. The answer is yes, but, and the first part may be interesting to you in a general way. I hope that the but part will be quite interesting, because I think this, you can think of this as fundamental issues that need to be considered by the field if you look at what the real world wants. Those of you who are familiar with the book Pasteur's Quadrant, this is a view from Pasteur's Quadrant. Okay, so let me start out with the real world. I'm taking my cue from this study done by the DOE. I think most of you are familiar with that. And there was sort of a fundamental science panel, and there was a panel that looked at the needs as looked at from the point of view of applications. And I was actually on the latter as the gray head. And we produced one figure that's in this report that I think deserves a lot of attention. So this is from the DOE report. And the bottom line here, so let me give you the bottom line and explain what it means. YBCO is not good enough for applications above 77 Kelvin. I don't think there's any argument about that anymore. Okay? And this is a serious issue, because YBCO is, as many of us know, and I think many of you have some sense, is the best of the cuprates for applications. So none of the others, even with higher TCs, are going to be useful for applications. So it's important to understand this as we think about higher temperature superconductivity. So just look at the left-hand side. The right-hand side is the same story. So what's shown here is the critical current density versus field, okay, at 77 Kelvin. And this is at the time of the report where YBCO stood. It's a little better now. What's shown here in these light green areas is what power industry would like. This is the range of fields and currents which are present in power cables. These are transformers. These are rotating machines. And we know full well those guys aren't going to change the design of their machines to suit us, so we have to meet them. That's fine. You can say, well, we're pretty close here. And in fact, some engineering experiments are going on with power lines using YBCO. That's a great thing. Transformers and rotating machines require higher fields, so they come later. This is the line I want to draw your attention to, though. This line is the theoretical limit of what you're going to get out of YBCO. This is the bottom line. It's awfully close. And so however clever the materials people are, and they are clever, I think most of us, and they themselves would agree, are unlikely to push this line up above there so close to what the fundamental limit is. And I'll come back to what I mean by the fundamental limit. So this is serious. So the notion in the report is you need this. Well, this is third generation. This is second generation. These are sort of the engineering terms. But the point of this figure, and as stated in the report, is another material is needed. So that's the green line. It's thinking that through that is the sort of structure of my talk.
Are you going to explain what 2G and
3G? Yeah, 2G, there was in the parlance of the development of the cuprate superconductors, 1G was the BSCO wires, 2G is YBCO tapes, 3G is what would be necessary to operate above 77 Kelvin. So let's look at the theoretical limit versus transition temperature. Now, you would think that as the transition temperature goes up, that current would get higher. And for the conventional low-temperature superconductors, it does. And if it were simply proportional to TC, it would be up here somewhere. And here's MGB2, and here's YBCO. So they're not an extrapolation of the low-temperature superconductors. Okay. But what's going on here, and what are the implications? I mean, this is a sobering, as Brian Maple said to me this morning, that's a sobering plot, and it is. But we'll see. So what's the physics lying behind this? Now, I'm going to, I don't want to insult you or embarrass myself, but this is freshman superconductivity, okay? So I'm not going to say anything profound. Well, I'm going to say something important, but it's not stuff you don't know. You just may not have thought of it this way. So let's look at, I mean, this is essentially asking the question, what's the D-pairing critical current? But for audiences that aren't as sophisticated as you, I just say, look, let's calculate the thermodynamic limit, okay? It's as simple as saying, okay, if I have a supercurrent, there's a kinetic energy associated with that, and when that kinetic energy density exceeds the condensation energy, it's over. Okay, never mind D-pairing, that's a small fact. But there's this only so much condensation energy. Okay, well, you can calculate that, that's just the kinetic energy. Now we can rewrite that in terms that you're more used to. Here's the sort of penetration depth. So here is the kinetic inductivity. It's just the kinetic inductance, however you want to look at it. So there's an energy in the stored current. Now the coefficient that comes here is just related to the penetration depth, as we all know, okay? And this coefficient here is also 1 over that is the superfluid phase stiffness. I'll come back to that. So you just say, okay, if I increase the current density, the energy goes up. When I hit the normal state, I'm through. That current density is given by this formula. This is very elementary, almost a London theory. And, you know, we know these numbers. So we can do this. Okay, so we know what it is in terms of Hc and lambda, but let's ask, what does it depend, how does it depend on materials parameters that are closer to the real materials themselves? Well, this is the sort of Ginzburg-Landau result. Jc, this thermodynamic critical current, depends on the density and the superfluid velocity, but as we all know, that goes as 1 over the coherence length. Now, if you'll allow me a sort of BCS-ish sort of thing, the coherence length goes as the Fermi velocity over TC0, and I'll show you what real materials do in a minute, but I think this is plausible, okay? And if you'll allow me to say that the superfluid density, the delta function weight, if you like, is something, you know, cannot be less than, more than the total carrier density, then I find at best JC scales like this. Okay, two things. Yes, it should go up as TC goes up, and we saw that the elemental superconductor, or the conventional superconductors do that. I'm going to fudge on this a little bit. The problem with MGB2 and YBCO is this density is too small. Okay, or is smaller than you would like. And that's why you see this rollover. Okay? That's what's underlying this plot. Okay? So that's a little awkward. But we know that this superfluid density, or the phase stiffness, also governs the fluctuations of the phase. This is a well-known argument. Steve Kivelson gave it this morning, and I just cribbed these formulas from his paper with these gentlemen. People, I guess I should say. So you all know the story. If you take the phase and you wind it pi, or fluctuates by amount pi, over a volume that's the size of the Cooper pair, and that's a coherence, and this is sort of for a two-dimensional material. So I describe the weak coupled dimension by putting in the anisotropy of the mass in the Ginzburg-Landau theory. And you just calculate this kinetic energy, set that phase gradient equal to pi over C. We all know this argument. And you get this formula. Okay? And what it says is, you want a large C and you want a large N sub S. Well, and you want low anisotropy. Okay? So TC is the minimum then, as Steve argued this morning. It's either the pairing temperature or this phase fluctuating temperature, depending on where you are. Okay? Well, clearly, if you want to have, if you have a strong pairing temperature, you want to get this phase fluctuating temperature comparable to it or larger than it. And that depends on, again, you'll see this N sub S. This will bring in TC, and there's the anisotropy. So these very elementary properties of the superconductor really matter. Now, historically, the paradigm for searching for new higher temperature superconductors was increase the interactions, or N is 0 V, however you want to look at it. You get a large pairing energy, and everything else follows. Now, that's not silly. It was true for a long time. And, you know, useful things were done with that strategy. But the new paradigm is, I think, in light of these considerations, you want strong interactions and get a large pairing energy. But you better have low anisotropy and high carrier density if you want to have a usable JC, and in fact, you want to not, and you can avoid being limited by these phase fluctuations. It's as simple as that. Okay? So, this is pretty simple. I think you would agree. Now, if you think this through, we now have the basic ingredients. Now, I agree with Paul. I mean, a higher temperature superconductor that's isotropic would be wonderful, but allow me to be slightly hyperbolic here. Is a room temperature superconductor possible from this point of view? In other words, within some anthropomorphic view of materials or whatever that means. Well, the answer is yes, but there are some lessons. This is probably the most important figure in my talk. So what I did here is to say, okay, let's take YBCO. Okay, so this is YBCO here. Now, coming down this column is the pairing temperature. Okay, so it goes up to 360 just for fun. Going across here, well, I'm going to look at the anisotropy, and then I'm going to look at the density. Okay. So this is YBCO. So I take the behavior of YBCO, and I normalize critical current to that value. So that's 1 by definition. And if you calculate T phi over TP for YBCO, it's 1.6, which is, you know, that's good. So now, bear with me as I walk you through this, because I don't want to belabor it too much, but I think the moral is very interesting. If I were to take YBCO and change nothing, well, take YBCO, you know, conceptually, and increase the pairing temperature, okay, the, that's here, I'd get some benefit in the critical current would go up by a factor 4. The phase temperature over the pairing temperature goes down to 0.1. So from this, these are the relationships I've just given. If you think through what I've just told you, these are the scaling relationships. So if I went up to a pairing temperature of 360 Kelvin, the actual transition temperature would be 36 Kelvin. The reason is because the coherence length would get smaller. And that's bad for the phase fluctuation. That's here, okay? So that's not good enough, which is why I say there has to be a new paradigm as you really get aggressive about what you want. Okay, so let's maybe go across here, and then I'll stop going through the details. If I get rid of the, I just did this. If I get rid of the anisotropy, well, that helps here. It doesn't help in the critical current density, although it would for the vortex pinning and whatnot. Okay, so as I go up, but here, if I start increasing the density, I really start to gain. Okay, the critical current starts to go up. It's proportional then. And the phase temperature, because it also depends on the superfluid stiffness, does pretty well too. So now let me just jump down here. If I were to make it isotropic and increase the density by 10, okay, from YBCO, then I would have really a lot more critical current density. And it would be a very stable, a robust superconductor against phase fluctuations. And I can even back off here to a factor of 2 and make it isotropic, and it's a lot better. So it's not hopeless, okay? It can be done from these elementary considerations. The question is, how do you get there? I mean, now we come to the questions that I think are really interesting to a group like this. Okay? Now, I've given this talk to a number of types of groups. So here are the questions that come out of this. Some of them are fundamental, some are practical. These are the ones that I think interest us here, but these are for other-minded people, but let me just give you those as well. Here's the deep one. Does high TC require reduced dimensionality and low carrier density? I ask that question to every theorist I know, and I get mixed answers, which means it's a good question. Okay? So if it is, then we have to live with that. But And what mechanisms are effective for making such small pairs? I mean, these, as the temperature goes up, the coherence length will go down. So we need to think about small pairs. And what are the physical properties of superconductors in the very small Cooper limit? Well, there's a good bit known about that. This is the opposite of the BCS. But certainly people who think about phenomenology of superconductors need to get a little more informed about that. So I think these are good questions. And they're coming out of considerations of practicality. Now, there's another set here. This is more for the vortex physics crowd, but since we all, or some of us, actually played in that landscape, and at least know people who do, let me tell you what they are. One of them is, how good can a bad superconductor be? We don't have a good understanding of flux pinning and how it all goes and how to achieve it and maximize it in the presence of strong thermal or even quantum fluctuations. Okay, that's what vortex phase physics people worry about. And it also doesn't like the anisotropy, as we all know. But there's another one, and this is really for the engineers. How good is good enough? You don't have to have zero resistance. It just has to be low enough to be useful. So it'll be interesting in the next decade or so, see how this plays out when these two people, groups of people, get together and are more quantitative about what we really need. But I'm not going to deal with those issues here. This conference and works and program here at KITP are about TC. So I'm going to go on without dealing with those issues. Guidance, Paul put it well this morning. He used that word, and I'm going to use it too. I'm going to be almost obnoxious about it. What we need is guidance. Guidance for very high temperature superconductors, okay? What can, you know, it's hard work. And so how I think theory can help. Now let me come back to this issue of the size of the Cooper pair. Now we all know from BCS that it goes as 1 over TC, right? And so here are the coherence lengths. This is a log scale, angstroms, and this is log TC. So log-log plots are always a little tricky. But this would be going as 1 over TC. Here are the low temperature superconductors. And here's YBCO. So surely, as TC goes up, the coherence length or size of the Cooper pairs get smaller. I mean, that we all know that, and this is just a quantification of that. So whether you like the argument for it going as 1 over TC based on BCS or not, empirically, that's what it does. So let's extrapolate it out here to room temperature, just for fun. Okay, it comes here. Well, okay, so somewhere in this range here, which is interesting because here is the separation between the electrons for various electron densities. Okay, so what it says is we're getting down, so this is 1 angstrom, this is 10 angstrom. So you can say it's getting down to something like the carrier density in mean separation. In any event, it tells you that the Cooper pairs are going to be something like a unit cell in dimension, maybe 2, 1, whatever, small. Now that's okay, and I think lots of people appreciate that. But something I'd like to follow up on, and there are some good materials chemists here, if the pairs are that small, can we now shake hands with the solid-state chemists? Okay? We're really talking about what happens inside a unit cell. That's a very different point of view than although all of us were raised thinking in K-space. But once you get that small, I think George will address this in this particular case this afternoon in his talk, I think that's really worth thinking about. Look, I've met Akimitsu and Onoso. They're wonderful solid-state chemists, two very different personalities. They're certainly smart, okay? But they don't deeply or even usefully understand superconductivity. That's not a criticism. It's really a criticism of us because we've not told them what superconductors require in terms they understand. We don't have a mutual language. Maybe we could. And that would make a big difference, I would claim. I mean, everybody likes to say, look, all these things get discovered by mistake, not by mistake, by serendipity. And that may be true, but remember, you have to know what you're looking for if you're going to think about it in a proactive way. And I don't think we have made that effort yet. Well, this is my sort of version of what Paul was saying this morning. We all know this. You know, we have all these high-temperature superconductors. And I think, and I this is really for the materials panel this afternoon, but what do they tell us? Okay, well, I have a table here. I'm not going to go through it because that's what they're going to do this afternoon. But let me show you the structure of it. Okay, we have these archetypical materials. We have their TCs. What are the interactions? Well, there's some uncertainty here. And if we have some idea what that is or what makes it interesting, what is the guidance? Okay, this is my table. It doesn't matter. There are better people equipped to do this than I. But you get the idea. It's guidance. Now, my own personal view is I like these electronic interactions, charge and spin. They're effective. And as Steve pointed out this morning, the energies are big. Okay, U and T are big numbers. That makes it attractive. And I believe, well, I don't know if I believe in that, but I think it's interesting enough to go pursue. And this, he showed a plot effectively like this. This is the calculations, Skeletor and all, but the 2D negative Hubbard model. And this is just an example, okay? Here's TC, here's U over T. Steve showed plots in his case of that plane. Here's the doping. Okay, the point is, for in terms of guidance, is the lessons that he alluded to. If you believe that this has something to do with reality, then you want U and T to be comparable, U equal to the bandwidth, and you want to get the doping right. Well, this is a paradigm for helping you to search. Okay? And if you find a low TC, you have to figure out, and this is relevant, you have to figure out, well, am I over here? Am I over here? And if I'm over here, I do one thing. If I'm over here, I do another. That's useful. It gives you a way to think about what you're doing. And we all, and as Paul said, now we're worried about the doping, and that makes the search was doubly difficult numerically or something like that. But still, having confidence that this is the basic structure, that there is a maximum in this space, is very useful. And it leads to certain conclusions about what the material parameters ought to be. Yeah, that's fine. To make it all work. So how can theory help? Paul said this, I'm going to say this, and I don't want to make enemies of my theoretical friends, but I'm going to keep saying it all summer. Okay, how can theory help? Prediction is not necessary. You can't do it, so don't worry about it. I mean, the closest we can come is people like Warren, and I think he would not, he's not super offended by my statement. Guidance is enough, okay? And that's what Paul said. You know, guidance. I'm a little calmer person than he is. Pardon? Well, I have my jeans on. Anyway, so could we have? Now, you know, I'm serious here, but I want to be also a little provocative and slightly outlandish. So take me seriously, but recognize I'm really trying to get at the theorists to think about these things. Do we need, could we have, and do we need a real space formulation of the model microscopic theories, including the relevant dynamics? Because it is a real space thing as you go up in TC. I would submit an intuitive basis. Okay? That would be useful. Can we get useful associated electronic structure studies to provide guidance on the parameters of these low-energy Hamiltonians in terms of the high-energy, or however you want to put it, physics, namely the chemical constituents in the structure, those inputs? Can we get guidance on how those relate? Because as Paul and others who work so hard at these things, they've got the periodic table, they've got structures, and so on and so forth, and they try to make inferences about what might be good. But if it has to do with nesting of the Fermi surface and bosons and whatnot, that's fine. That's a perfectly good way to look at it. But it's hard to relate those to these chemical and structural issues. And it seems to me an interesting question is, as it begins to get more local and more real space oriented, can we make connection with these things more usefully? And if we can, I go back to my statement earlier, can we shake hands with the solid-state chemists? I think everybody understands that reduced dimensionality is bad from the point of view of the practical performance, and it may be good for TC, and if it is, how can we get it in a 3D structure? And there's plenty of examples of structures that give you one-dimensional sort of conducting regions and planes and all of that. But we need that in a three-dimensional structure. I have nothing against three-dimensional materials. I work on them too. But we have to bear in mind that once we figure out why that's working, can we get it in a three-dimensional structure? Can we get a three-dimensional structure that will have this part of the unit cell that's got this action that Steve's talking about, and another part that gives us his conducting planes? And he's got a model, but can we get that model in a crystal? Okay? Negative U's coupled to some conduction band or whatever. Okay? I don't know. I don't see why not. And then I come back to this. Can we find a mutually understandable language between ourselves and the solid state chemists? I think that would be very good thing to do. I had this discussion with Zach Fisk, and he couldn't agree more. And finally, we need good luck. So wish us good luck. Harold Weinstock, bless his heart, has given a number of us a chance to go look, and we need the luck. Okay, I won't grade myself, but since I'm a part of management, and I was given instructions by my colleague there, Eduardo, I don't know whether I answered these questions well, but these are the ones I feel I addressed. So I want an A for effort. Thank you.
There is time for a few questions. Let me remind you that in some middle schools in this country, we have an office for military training students called the guidance.
The guidance. At my age, that's called a financial planner, but we're... Yes?
Yeah, but just to amplify a bit what you were saying, I'll ask you this question too when you gave your colloquium in Leiden, and I think it's a very relevant one. So you basically say you have to pull up that root weight, right, in order to suppress the phase fluctuations and perhaps, especially to get a high critical current.
That means that also to keep the phase fluctuations
out. All clear. Yeah. But it means that you have to make a very, very, very good metal.
I know.
And there is an enormous force in nature, and that is when your root weight gets very, very, very big, the screening power of your electron system gets very, 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 very large. And the screening power means that all interesting interaction effects are completely wiped out and screened away at length scales smaller than the unit cell. And all you end up that can work for you is phonons, but phonons won't give you that high a TC. So isn't it so that to get at room temperature superconductivity, that is by principle mission impossible?
No, I don't agree with that. I agree with everything you said but the last statement. No, he knows that too, but no, I don't feel that way. I mean, everything you said is right. And as the density goes up, you know, you got to worry that you're just going to get tin and indium again, right? I mean, that's the sort of way you think. And I worry about that too, but I'm encouraged by, I mean, I don't, you know, you can't take, I think you all understand the spirit of what I was doing here. Don't take it literally, just take the message. But you know, you don't, let's take it literally for the moment. Yeah, this is fine. And you know, who says it has to be room temperature, you know? But I think getting above 70, if you talk to the people who really deal with these practical issues, they do want to get above 77 Kelvin. Room temperature is just a kind of sexy thing to talk about, okay? So somewhere in here, it would be fine. And that's sort of Paul's point too. I mean, 100 Kelvin isotropic superconductor would be damn useful. I agree. I just wanted to put it in the extreme, but I do believe that you have to be sensitive to this anisotropy and density question, or you will shoot yourself in the foot. And that's why it's a deep question.
Yeah, but Mac, the bottom corner of that is what I call the six-legged chicken. Mm-hmm. If you like drumsticks and you can raise a six-legged chicken, you get more drumsticks, but six-legged chickens are hard to come by. So I really think that your argument is, in essence, indeed favoring the fact that maybe a TC of 100 and 140 isotropic is really the ideal that may be tractable. I end up with a little bit of discouragement from your analysis of room temperature, because I don't think you're going to have a really high carrier density metal pulling off sort of the low carrier density physics that we see with the high TCs.
My first question.
Well, I have a question. Yeah. I have refrained myself to ask questions so far.
Okay.
So, or comments, rather. I give it to you. Don't worry, you have your chances. So there is actually a theoretical question that people have asked over the years, is that why is TC so low, mm-hmm. not why is it so high?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, after all, you think that the relevant scale actually recuperates is J.
Yeah.
And it's quite a bit lower than that, so there is a question, why can't we make it as high? Maybe that's not the question for you.
I'll give you my answer. I mean, if you go to the underdoped cuprate, there's a lot of stuff going on. But I don't doubt for a moment that part of it is phaseless in some broad sense. If the density is just too low. Steve, I think you'd agree with me.
So you talked a lot about spatial anisotropy, but another thing is if you have Coulomb interactions, you get an anisotropic pair, you know, E-wave or some unconventional.
Yeah.
From a practical point of view, is that also very bad?
No.
You're willing
no,
to
No, I'll give you a very simple, I mean, this is too simple of an answer, but you'll understand the spirit which is given. If you look at the Ginzburg-Landau theory, which is the theory of superconductivity as opposed to superconductors, it doesn't care whether it's, I mean, you get time reversal symmetry breaking, okay, fine. But if it's D, it's the same. So all these relationships still work. The details may come in and change, but I don't see any problem with the D wave, for example. Not these practical applications. And this is the one that, you know, in the back of our minds, I mean, I'm all for physics, and nobody's going to doubt that I love doing what I'm doing, okay? But, you know, we better be careful. We're saying that we're going to revolutionize the world without actually asking the question, well, what would it take? That's all I'm saying. That's the sober side.
I want to get back to Jan's questions and Paul's questions and maybe even Eduardo's question. If what Jan said were true and all interesting interaction except phonons are wiped out in good metals, you would never have room temperature ferromagnetism. And there is one interaction in the system, which is at least one, which is very insensitive to screening, and this is Hundrell coupling. Hundrell coupling makes metal iron ferromagnetic. Hundrell's coupling, as most people believe now, is operative in nictides. And also, that answers your scale. Answers your question about the scale. The scale of magnetic interaction in cuprates, which are strongly coupled materials, is set by T squared over U, where U is a large number. The scale of magnetic interaction in a system like metal iron is set by totally different numbers, and it can be quite large. And also, I remember very well the time when it was considered to be a condition on any good theory of superconductivity to predict limiting critical temperature on the order of 30 Kelvin, which was experimental fact. So I think we are a little bit under this spell now when we think that reasonable theory of superconductivity should predict critical temperature of the order of 150 Kelvin.
Hey, I've just dedicated the last 5 years of my career for looking, so don't tell me I don't believe, guys, okay? We both pay taxes, right?
Meg, I like your analysis, and I think it is conclusive, but I'm wondering about the following. A room temperature superconductor, in particular a viable one with a large JC at room temperature, will be a completely new beast. I don't think it will resemble much the superconductors which we know. Now, in your derivations, you've, of course, used quite a number of assumptions.
Very few, but let's. I'll enumerate them. I've thought about this. Good question.
I'm trying to put it in a funny way. You know,
yeah.
In 10 years, when we'll have this meeting with these great superconductors, which have a TC of 500 Kelvin and a very low carrier density, you may say, okay, my analysis was completely correct, but I just didn't think that it was possible that it could be such and such a material. Just It's outside the.
No, I agree, and if that turns out to be the case, you won't see me cry. Okay. However, you know, I think it's more serious than that. To be honest with you, I mean, I am optimistic, but I'm going to have fun trying. That delta function weight just comes in, right? Okay, I called it n, so it'd be simple, but it's really the weight of the delta function, okay? And I know that's more complicated than the group rate. This is a sophisticated audience, so let's talk about that. You've got to keep that up. If you don't have that weight, you're not going to carry current, and it's going to phase fluctuate. I'm sorry. This has nothing to do with sophisticated things. This is very simple. It's hard to get away from it. A superconductor is a complex number with an amplitude and a phase, right? That's superconductivity. Okay? No getting around it. Now, we can talk about mechanisms and all the stuff that underlies the parameters that go into that theory, but that's it. Call it Ginsburg-Landau theory, whatever you want. That's it. Or XY model. I don't care. That's it. That's a superconductor. If this material is not a superconductor in that sense, that's really extraordinary. But if it is, these things are not going to go away. So we need to think about
them. I'm glad this transparency is up, because I wondered if you could comment on your last question, which might allow us to look at things that aren't even quite superconductors.
Yeah, well, you know.
So how good does it have to be?
Well, I don't know how good it has to be. That's a question of how much better than copper. I mean, you know, these are the little oversimplified, but they're useful characterizations of the issue. Now, Paul Grant, who worked at EPRI for a long time, I asked him this question. He said, 100. And I said, where does that come from? He said, out of my head. So nobody's really thought about it. Now, if you want NMR magnets, then that's another matter. I'm restricting this to power applications, not because I think that's the, well, in some sense, maybe it is the most important. But I'm trying to keep it confined to something I can actually talk about. Well, there was a young woman when I gave this talk at the version of this talk at the MRS meeting this spring, got up and said, well, maybe we could do it with carbon fiber. Not what I wanted to hear, but.
Mac, I have a comment. I think there's two things wrong with YBCO. It probably cannot be made into the cables that people would like. The other is, it's still two orders of magnitude more expensive than copper, even given all the wonderful things they've done. And those two things are really making it impossible to go ahead with most practical applications, particularly the ones you mentioned.
Yeah, no, I agree, and thank you for pointing that out. I'm well aware of that, but I'm not trying to deny that a material that is sort of comparable to YBCO but cheaper would be as revolutionary. But the reason I phrased it the way I did here is this is a workshop about higher TC superconductors and stuff. But Harold's completely right.
I just wanted to jump in with what Jan and Igor said. Of course, you know, eventually the whole theories or the whole descriptions we have in solid state physics of what happens to screening lengths when densities get very high and screening lengths become extremely small,
right,
they break down, because I should then take into account that I really have in non-uniform polarizable media and all this kind of stuff. We have atoms and not free electron gases.
Yeah,
and when you do that,
yeah,
when you take that into account, then just like Igor said, atomic interactions become important, very short range things become important, polarizabilities become important. And then the whole story changes, actually. And I don't really, I agree with you. I don't see any reason why one couldn't get very...
Well, you're saying real space and really local.
Yes, exactly. And so look,
well, I'm not, I mean, I sort of believe in that, but I'm not, like you two gentlemen, sort of equipped to say it too strongly in an audience like this. Okay. I'm a plumber. I'm a better plumber than he is, but I'm a plumber. Yeah, that's right. He believes in six-footed chickens, okay.
So I was at Mac.
Sorry. Mike, go ahead.
So I was sort of intrigued by your sort of TC versus coherence link plot.
Mm-hmm.
So the slope is actually bigger than 1. I just did a back, and it looks like something like 1.5. I mean, has people done a systematic study of this? I mean, more extensive chart? Maybe some interesting physics hidden in this low.
Maybe, maybe not. If you'll allow me the BCS view, there's a Fermi velocity in there, and I've been ignoring that. And of course, if you change that, you'll change the number. So I don't know whether that's a systematic change in the Fermi velocity going on. That's an answerable question. I'm embarrassed I haven't checked that because I'm aware of that. But it makes my point. Even if it went down purely BCS-like, you're still down such that these statements are true.
Matt, can you go back to your TC and JC plot, the one where MGB2 was the local maximum? Yeah, okay, so you're pulling it at 6 × 10⁸ amps per square centimeter. Of course...
Well, I should say, if there's any ambiguity about... I mean, this is basically depends on lambda.
Right, right.
So I've used the best lambda I could find.
Have you put a second data set onto this? TC stays the same, but the maximum experimentally realized JC, because in many cases... getting JC up is the huge struggle, and MGB2 is way below that at this point. And I don't know how, for example, niobium-310 compares to.
Oh, it's on here actually. There it is.
Well, that's so. No. The real JC.
Oh, it's about 10% of the D-pairing critical current.
So it's way down.
Well, factor 10 down.
Okay, fine. All right. Okay, so...
But this is the thermodynamic limit.
Oh, understood. I was just trying... If we're trying to do real world...
Okay, no, I can answer that question. I mean, niobium titanium and in niobium 310, optimized materials, the workhorse materials, typically with the best material science, they can get within 10%, which is pretty damn amazing, of the D-pairing critical. Within 10%, 90%, sorry. No, sorry. No, you're right. I misspoke. It's 90%. Well, I mean, take 90% of that, and that would be typical experience. No, I'm saying that's an expectation of a fully optimized material science engineered material would be 90% of that number. Yeah.